in and heads to the market. On the way, Mei Lin thinks about how different it is to live in the city among the Taiwanese. At the Zhuanchun, most residents were so certain they would be returning to China, they never bothered to venture beyond the compound. Like Auntie Chin, many of them looked down on the Taiwanese as a Japanized race that needed to reconnect with the motherland. The few Ben Zhengren Mei Lin had met didn't seem to like the Chinese from the mainland either. Wai Zhengren, people from outside the province, they called them. Outside the Zhuanchun, she senses it even more. Mei Lin knows, as a new face to Mr. Tsai, she'll get just one chance to make a good impression. So, before approaching him, she lingers near his stall, watching the interactions. Whenever someone comes up to Mr. Tsai speaking Mandarin, he acts as though he doesn't understand. This is intriguing. Mandarin is the official language. Mr. Tsai must know what these people want, but he maintains a blank face. When they shout and insist, writing the characters on a piece of paper and waving it in his face, Mr. Tsai says he has no more rice, or that his shop is closed. He refuses to sell them anything. Or he offers a small, overpriced scoop of broken rice riddled with gravel. But when someone speaks Taiwanese, Mr. Tsai's face opens. They chat for a long time. Only after this exchange do they hold out their bags for Mr. Tsai. He fills their sacks with new crop rice. After a little while, Mei Lin slips away. She won't try to buy rice yet. She carries on with her errands, thinking about Mr. Tsai. Mei Lin has always had an ear for languages. In Shanghai, she had picked up enough Shanghainese to blend in. And in Chongqing, she'd gotten much better prices in the market when she switched to Sichuanese. She thinks of how Auntie Deng and Uncle Liang howled at her early attempts. Yet, they became her friends, and in time, her lifeline. Mei Lin smiles to herself, but then her reminiscence is clouded by the memory of the great tunnel disaster. It's been 14 years. If that hadn't happened, maybe the family wouldn't have splintered. Maybe they'd all be here in Taiwan together. Li Ling would be 23, maybe even a mother herself. Mei Lin sighs and shakes herself out of her daydream. No rice will come from sad memories. It's clear. Now that she lives outside the Zhuanchun, she must learn Taiwanese. Her errands bring her to Yongle Fabric Market in Da Dao Cheng. Mei Lin wants to find buttons and braiding for Madame's latest dress. A highlight of working for the Huangs is that Madame has a sewing machine that she not only allows, but expects Mei Lin to use. After selecting what she needs, Mei Lin browses up and down the stalls, looking for bargains. Her eye falls on a light green cotton printed with small pink flowers. On impulse, she buys a few yards and heads home. On her way, she notices a pair of women walking in the opposite direction. Over their arms, each carries a woven rattan basket filled with piles of linens. Curious, Mei Lin turns and follows. Where could they be going? The river. They are heading to the Tamsui. Once there, they join other women washing clothes on the shore. They all seem to know each other and share a sense of camaraderie that Mei Lin misses. Some have children who help or play in the water. It reminds Mei Lin of how women in the Zhuanchun would gather to do the washing, exchanging jokes and gossip, making the burdensome task lighter. She listens carefully, trying to make out the words. These are Ben Zhengren women, happily speaking in Taiwanese. At first, Mei Lin is surprised. Over-eager to enforce the government's Mandarin-only policy, the ever-present military police are likely to arrest anyone they hear speaking Taiwanese. But here, Mei Lin reflects, the splash and gurgle of the river covers the women's voices and grants them a small freedom. When the weekly drudgery of doing the laundry next arises, maybe Mei Lin will bring her basket to the Tamsui and see what she can learn. The river water ripples over a shallow pebble bed. Mei Lin dunks in the clothes, watching them darken. They lose their crispness and become heavy. She rolls her shoulders, which ache from carrying the basket for so far. Squatting, she scrubs a bar of soap into the folds of fabric, coaxing the suds into a rich foam. Nearby, other women wash and rinse, slapping the clothes on the large stones to get the water out, then wringing them into tight coils stacked into their baskets. That first day, a few eye her suspiciously, and no one speaks to her. Still, no one tells her to go away. The wet washing, even when wrung out, is so much heavier on the way back. Maylin spends a precious coin to hire a pedicab back to the Huang's house. Week after week, she returns and becomes more accustomed to the work. Washing changes from being her most dreaded chore to part of her weekly rhythm. A few women at the river start to recognize her, ask her name, become friendly. She picks up a few phrases in Taiwanese, and some of the women, in appreciation of her efforts, teach her more. When she asks why the Bun Zhengren don't like the White Zhengren, they look away and change the subject. They reassure her that they like her, she's different. But eventually, with the rushing waters muffling their whispers, they tell her about the events of February 28, 1947, 2 years before Meilin and Ren Xu arrived in Taiwan. Meilin pieces together the story of 228 bit by bit. They tell her how a Bun Zhengren widow was selling cigarettes in defiance of the tobacco board monopoly. They recount the widow's refusal to stop when asked and the way the crowd supported her. With disgust, they tell about the cowardly officer who fired a shot into the crowd, killing someone by accident, followed by the not-so-accidental killing of thousands of civilians. Since then, thousands have been persecuted by the Kuomintang. Kidnapped, disappeared, killed. This is taboo. No one can talk about this, they say. But everyone does. Everyone aches to tell how someone they know, someone they loved, was brutalized. As always, Meilin listens. She didn't know. She wants to weep with them for their losses, for their suffering. She begins to understand the animosity she felt when they first arrived in Taiwan. Through the whisperings and fellowship at the river, Meilin becomes friendly with a younger woman called Lin Na, who lost her mother in the 228 massacre. Meilin says that she, too, knows what it is to lose family in someone else's fighting. Over time, the two become close. Sometimes, Meilin brings extra food for Lin Na and her cousins to share. When Lin Na admires the madame's clothes and Meilin reveals that she sewed them, Lin Na asks Meilin to alter some of her own clothing. Lin Na has a stall in the Yongle fabric market, and she offers Meilin good deals on some of the nicest bolts of cloth. When only a few days' worth of rice remain, Meilin confides in Lin Na that she needs to be able to buy rice, but fears that she'll only get the worst kind because of her accent. Lin Na introduces her to Mr. Tsai, and by the end of that day, Meilin not only has a new supply of rice, but she has also made a friend in Mr. Tsai. Chapter 13. Taipei, Taiwan, January 1960. Ren Xu is on his way to meet his friends for celebratory noodles. His feet are light, like springs, full of possibility. He reaches down and runs his finger along the edge of the envelope in his pocket, tracing the perforated ridges of the stamps. Last year, when he was finishing his final exams and preparing for military service, Ren Xu began to imagine a life beyond NTU, beyond Taiwan. Inspired by the announcement that Li Zhengdao and Yang Zhenming had won the 1957 Nobel Prize in Physics, Ren Xu and his classmates began to dream of going to the US for graduate school. Ren Xu has done well, and his professors have encouraged him to continue with his studies once he finishes his mandatory service. To help in the fight against communism, the government has been recruiting top students in technical fields to study in the US. Ren Xu knows his ma would be thrilled for him to become a professor. Although she might not have imagined him going to America, it is clear to Ren Xu that this is the future. He investigates the requirements. The challenge of going to the US for graduate study has many steps. he must complete a 4-year degree, complete his required military service, demonstrate proficiency in English, prove political aptitude and suitability, gain admission to a US graduate program, find a sponsor and financial means, and obtain a visa. Piece by piece, he has been working on this problem for a long time. After graduating from NTU with high honours, he is now completing his conscription. And today, Renshu has another piece in his pocket, an offer from the graduate program in mechanical engineering at Northwestern University, Evanston, Illinois, USA. At the noodle place, his friends are already celebrating. Pao has been accepted at NYU to study physics, Liu will be going to the University of Wisconsin for electrical engineering, and his friend and academic rival, Li Hotan, holds a letter from Columbia.
Dao Renshu, where will you go?
Renshu brandishes his letter from Northwestern and joins them in a toast. Renshu turns his attention to the next step in the process. To get his visa, he needs proof of a US bank account containing $2,400. Renshu's friends have connections. Fathers in the government, rich relatives in Hong Kong. Some already have family in America. They will all be able to find those funds. $2,400? Renshu doesn't even have 24 cents. But there must be a way. He couldn't have got this far otherwise. He brings the letter to Mei Lin.
Ma, I have news,
Renshu starts. Mei Lin puts down the pair of trousers she is mending and looks up. Strands of silver are starting to shimmer in her bun. He hands her the envelope. She, too, runs her fingers across the stamps. Turns it over, opens it, takes out the paper. It is all in English. She hands it back.
What is it?
It's an offer of admission to graduate school at Northwestern University in mechanical engineering. She is looking at him, smiling, but still puzzled.
In America.
America? A parade of emotions passes across Mei Lin's face. Disbelief, pride, uncertainty, sadness. For many months, Renshu has dreamed of this opportunity, but only now does he understand that it might break her heart. She blinks and shakes her head in amazement.
What's next? How does it work? She asks.
He explains to her about the bank account. She nods. He wants to go. She wants him to go. But they don't have the money. It is the year of the rat, and the Lees are having a Lunar New Year party at their villa. They have asked the Huangs if Mei Lin could come to help serve the guests. At the party are government officials and high-ranking military, as well as the influential and elite, at least those who manage to flee the mainland with their material wealth intact. Women coo over earrings and necklaces, admire one another's outfits. Men exchange handshakes and hearty greetings. Mei Lin enjoys standing on the periphery and feasting her ears on the chatter. Apparently, the new fashion will be for shorter qipaos. Mei Lin brightens to hear this. Shorter styles mean that she can save the scraps from the dresses Madame will want to alter. She'll sew them into purses, slippers, or maybe even silk underwear. Now the gossip drifts to who is expected tonight. There are excited whispers about one of the guests, a retired civil servant. Apparently, he was bold and brash in his youth, but this recklessness has paid off, and he was decorated by the Generalissimo. Yet, however much glamour is in the air, Mei Lin hears longing in these voices. Everyone has suffered. No one left China unscathed, no matter how much gold and jade they smuggled with them. Nothing in Taipei is ever quite as good as what they left behind. Another wave of guests has arrived. The party has become louder, merrier. Hurrying back and forth from the kitchen, Mei Lin refills platters with fresh, hot dishes. The wine has loosened tongues, which now remark on this 11th year of the Generalissimo's 5-year plan to retake the mainland. In the parlour, seated on plush cushions and at low zitan tables, groups of men play mahjong, chess, and go. Someone quips, How is it that they can be such masters at these games of strategy and still have lost the motherland? After several hours, Malin's feet are tired and most of the food has been eaten, the wine drunk. She is carrying a tray of dirty plates and empty glasses to the kitchen when she hears his voice in the parlour. She stops, strains to listen, doesn't hear it. She must be mistaken. No, there it is again. She'd know that voice anywhere. She knows its tenor, its timbre. She puts down her tray and peeks into the room. She freezes. She must be seeing a ghost. She retreats into the kitchen. Clearly, she's having a hallucination. Secondhand nostalgia and opium smoke are clouding her mind. Sui Mei, go find out the name of the gentleman in the smart suit at the mahjong game. A little old for you, don't you think? Mei Lin ignores the teasing and pushes the girl along. Go ask someone his name. The gesture is unnecessary. Of course it's him. Sui Mei soon hurries back, pronounces his name. Mei Lin sinks down. Do you know him? You know him! Oh, he's so sophisticated. How do you know him? Tell me. Mei Lin must be careful. No, she shakes her head. He's not who I thought he might be. She hopes this will throw Sui Mei off her trail. She needs to think about this. From an alcove in the corner, she watches him. He must be in his late 50s now. He walks with a slight limp. His suit hangs loose on his shoulders. His cheekbones are more prominent and his cheeks more sunken. He is somehow both softer and rougher. He reminds Mei Lin of Hong Se. What about Wen Ling and Li Fen? She looks around. Wen Ling must not be here. She would dominate the room if she were. The last of the evening glitters away. People make wishes for a prosperous year. Glasses clink to a glorious return to the mainland, but the toasts are as empty as the bubbles in the champagne. It is only when the guests are leaving that he walks over to Mei Lin. He puts his hand out to touch her arm. She jumps back and rubs her skin as if soothing a burn. Her stomach flips. You are real. It is you. He starts. She nods, unable to say a word. I know you are not a ghost, he continues, because when I see ghosts, they are never surprised to see me. But you are as shocked as I am. Mei Lin still says nothing. She is more than tongue-tied. She can't even think. Somehow, I thought I'd see you again, he says. I need to help clean up, she stammers finally. And Ren Shu? He asks, his voice softening. Graduated from NTU, she says. Her mouth is dry. Long Wei's face lights up. He's still here in Taipei? Mei Lin nods. Her pulse is throbbing. Someone calls her from the kitchen. She looks over and sees Sui Mei waving, grinning. Mr. Dao, sir, your car is here. A footman stands with his coat and fedora, waiting to escort Long Wei out of the villa. Thank you, he says, placing his hat lightly on his head. Mei Lin, my disappearing and reappearing sister-in-law. Let's meet tomorrow. Cafe Astoria. 4 o'clock. And with that, he's gone. Soon after Mei Lin started at the Huangs, Madame, pleased with her work, gave her the beautiful blue-green silk she'd shown her on that first day. When Ren Shu left for university, Mei Lin had set up Madame's sewing machine on the table where he'd studied. With plenty of light, enjoying the electric fan and strains of opera from Auntie Chin's radio in the kitchen, Mei Lin made herself the nicest dress she'd owned in years. She's only worn it a few times, to a Hubei Native Place Association festival, or the occasional party. Mostly, it hangs in the closet. From time to time, she holds the cool silk to her cheek and admires the soft shimmer. The morning after the New Year party, she puts it on. Needs a little adjustment, she thinks, tugging at the sleeves and around the waist. After changing back into her tunic and trousers, she makes the alterations, ripping out a row of stitches here, adding in new ones there. She tries it on again, twirling in front of a mirror,
trying to see the back, wondering if she should adjust the hem.
"You look lovely, my dear,"
Auntie Chin says from the door.
"I want to look strong," Mei Lin says.
"Strong?"
"Yes, strong, like someone who has taken care of herself and her family, like someone who can't be bossed around."
"That kind of strong isn't something you look like, it's something you are. And you, Mei Lin, are. Where are you going?"
"The dress will be fine," Mei Lin decides. She starts to brush her hair.
"I'm meeting..."
She pauses.
"Who is Long Wei to her?"
"A friend?"
"Someone I used to know,"
Mei Lin says, pinning her hair up.
"Well, I hope it's a nice reunion,"
Auntie Chin says pleasantly as she goes back to the kitchen.
"I do too," Mei Lin thinks.
Mei Lin told Auntie Chin she wanted to be strong, but she's jittery. On the way to the cafe, she calculates, it's been nearly 13 years since Yi Chang. 13 years. Where does one begin? Does she say, "I'm sorry for leaving"? But she's not. She's not sorry at all. She had to look for her parents. She had to try. What would have happened if she and Renshu had stayed? It's an impossible question. Does she say, "I'm glad to see you"? Is she? She was shocked to see him at the party. She still is. Maybe there's nothing to say. Maybe she should just turn back. What good could come from this? No, she'll go. She looks up. She's at Wuchang Street. She's only a few doors away now. There it is. Cafe Astoria. She looks through the rounded windows, intrigued by the treats on display, a tray of fluffy white candies with almonds catching her eye. As she enters, she is greeted by a wonderful whiff of confectionery. A staircase leads to the tables. Smoothing her hair, she heads up. He sits alone, his fingers fussing with a corner of the menu. She notices that the top of his head is balding. When he looks up, he smiles and, despite everything, Mei Lin can't help smiling back. A forgotten sensation flows through her. Here is someone who knew her before. Someone who remembers her life with Xiao Wen. Someone who understands what she lost and who she could have been. Whatever the outcome of their conversation today, she's grateful for this moment of deep recognition. He stands and pulls out a chair for her. His hand trembles slightly as he sits down.
"I was worried you might not show up."
"I was worried too," she says. He chuckles. His laugh seems more rounded than she remembers, just like his shoulders. She feels herself relax, just a little. Long Wei insists on ordering chocolate cake and dark coffees. His wallet, though fat with notes, is shabby, and the edges are soft and worn. To her surprise, he asks very little about the years since Yi Chang. She doesn't volunteer anything. He does, however, ask about Renshu. Mei Lin anticipated this. She shows him a photo of Renshu taken during his conscription. His eyes are serious, his cadet's uniform smartly pressed, his hair short under the cap that is almost too big for his head. Long Wei studies it carefully. When he raises his eyes, she sees they are glassy.
"He looks just like Xiao Wen."
"I know," she says. Handing it back to her, he sketches the outline of his story. Where was he? Shanghai, Nanjing, Chongqing, Chengdu, Taipei. How did he move? Trains, jeeps, steamboats, motorcycles, cars, and finally, a plane. And his career? It was good for several years, but it didn't take a military genius to see that the Generalissimo didn't want advisors or strategists, only yes men. Long Wei has been a lot of things, but never a yes man. To disagree with Chang was to write one's own obituary. After the Generalissimo's 5-year plan stretched into 6, then 7, Long Wei knew it was time. There are many secrets to being a good gambler, but the key is knowing when to walk away. When he saw the opportunity, he took a post of high rank and low power.
Then, as soon as would be respectable, he retired while his reputation was still intact. In all his talk, he hasn't mentioned what Mei Lin most wants to know. And what about Wen Ling and Li Fen? There is the smallest hesitation before he speaks. We were only in Shanghai a short time before I was relocated to Nanjing. There, we looked for her family, but their home was abandoned. We didn't find anyone. Mei Lin closes her eyes. When I had to return to Chongqing, she didn't want to go, of course. This time, she said, this time let me take Li Fen and go back to Shanghai. I couldn't say no. I planned to join them after the war. Although her own memories of Shanghai are painful, she understands why Wen Ling loved the city so much. She wonders if Li Fen grew out of her scowling resentfulness and into some greater ease with herself. But Long Wei's tone is ominous. What happened? She asks. Once Shanghai was no longer safe, I arranged for them to come here. They were supposed to be on the Taiping when... He falters. Mei Lin gasps, recalling the horror she'd felt after hearing two ships had collided on a dark January night, each having turned off their lights to avoid enemy detection. They drowned? Maybe. Maybe not. Their names weren't on the manifest. I don't know. He stirs a small spoon in his coffee, as if the clink and swirl might reveal something more. I sent her money for the tickets, but maybe she decided to go to Hong Kong instead. Maybe they stayed in Shanghai. I don't know. Their footprints are lost. Did you place missing person adverts? Did you look? Of course I looked. In Taipei, in Hong Kong, and up until communication was cut, I even put notices in the Shanghai papers. Nothing. I'm sorry. I am so sorry, Mei Lin murmurs. In the presence of Long Wei's grief, wounds that had grown numb feel newly raw. She reaches out towards Long Wei's arm and gives it a squeeze. He gently pulls away to take out a handkerchief, then blows his nose and shakes his head. Did you ever think of looking for us? He picks up his coffee and takes a sip, watching her over the rim. I didn't think you wanted to be found. She feels the colour rising up her cheeks. He puts the coffee down and reaches into his pocket for a handful of sunflower seeds. He starts cracking them with his teeth, and Mei Lin can hear him sucking the salt out of the shells. His teeth seem enormous. She puts her hand on the side of her coffee cup. It is cold. Why did you leave? He finally asks. I would have looked after you and Renshu. After all that we went through, you must have known that. She doesn't say anything. Didn't I always bring you supplies? Wasn't there always enough for Renshu's books and uniforms, for your cloth and thread? Ever since Xiao Wen was lost, was there ever a time I didn't look out for you? There are too many questions. She can't answer any of them. She can't return his gaze. In the long seconds that follow, something wakes in Mei Lin. A small voice that counters this dragon roaring his righteousness. Maybe she didn't want to be looked after. Maybe she hadn't needed Long Wei's overbearing shelter as much as he wants to believe. From the distance of more than a decade, it's easy for him to protest his good intentions. She doesn't entirely trust him. She never has. Call his bluff, says the voice. Mei Lin murmurs something to herself. What? Look at me to say what you have to say, he booms. But then, Mei Lin. His voice breaks over the syllables of her name. I said, and she slowly raises her eyes. I said, so help us now. He stares at her. Though her knee trembles under the table, she keeps her eyes even and lips calm. He lets out a low whistle and shakes his head slightly. Come, let's go. He pushes back his chair. They walk along the night market. Hawkers are selling snacks, offering fresh noodles and hot tea. Long Wei pauses at a stall filled with books, maps, and trinkets. He picks up a brass vase with a lapis inlay of a phoenix, turning it back and forth in his hand. Then he puts it down and continues browsing.
What are you looking for?
Meilin asks.
Just looking. Sometimes I find something special. Vases, jade, calligraphy. I am beginning to understand why my father collected those treasures.
Why? What do you think old Hongso was after?
She'd always thought it was about money. More ways to spread his investments.
Maybe he wanted beautiful objects. The kind that outlasts foolish humans. The artistry that goes into something like this.
He lifts the lid from a red lacquer jewellery box with an intricate carving of a willow and river.
Isn't changed by political machinations or intrigue. When all those are over, this will still be beautiful.
It's about more than beauty, Meilin says.
How so?
It's about strength, too. Endurance. An object can hold on to memories and stories in a way that people, that generations, cannot.
Where is her own scroll now?
She hopes it has been passed on to other, kinder hands.
Longwei shakes his head at the seller's raised eyebrows and puts the lid back on the box.
Meilin continues along the road home. He walks by Meilin's side, offers her a protective arm.
Are you courting me, old man?
She teases as she takes it.
Only for the past 25 years.
Even though it's dark, she hears the smile in his voice. To her surprise, she is smiling too.
Here we are,
she says brightly when they reach the Huangs. She puts one hand on the gate and one on his arm.
Come back for dinner with Renshu. He will be delighted to see you.
Next Saturday? With a squeeze on his arm, she signals goodbye, closing the gate behind her.
Chapter 14. Taipei, Taiwan, February 1960. After collecting the fish from the market, just as his ma asked, Renshu heads to Qidong Street. The Huangs are away in Hsinchu, so Auntie Chin is taking the weekend off. Meilin has asked him to help prepare dinner for a guest. She has also told him to bring all his documents for America. What is she thinking? She opens the door just as he's about to knock. Renshu hands her the fish, along with a punnet of fresh strawberries. She beams at the strawberries and takes the food into the kitchen as he changes into slippers.
Did you bring your papers too?
She calls.
Yes, Ma. Who is your mystery guest?
She emerges from the kitchen, drying her hands on her apron.
Renshu, Meilin says. Uncle Longwei is here in Taipei.
Uncle? Here?
Renshu exclaims in disbelief. He hasn't thought of uncle for years.
How? How did you find each other?
Meilin tells him about the party.
Renshu doesn't recall when they stopped looking for Longwei and the family, but part of him never stopped hoping they'd find them one day.
He shakes his head in amazement. I wonder if we've crossed paths and not even known it. And Auntie Wenling and Li Fen, are they coming tonight too?
Renshu, she starts. And with the change in tone of her voice, he knows.
What happened? He asks.
They were supposed to be on the Taiping the night it sank.
He sinks down into a seat, crestfallen to have found and then lost his aunt and cousin again in the space of a minute.
Then he thinks of Li Ling and the deep-rooted ache she left behind.
Renshu, we can ask him to help us.
But we never went back to the boat in Yichang, he hesitates.
Isn't he angry?
I don't know. Maybe not anymore. Even if he is angry, he still might help.
Come, we need to prepare the food.
Longwei arrives wearing a charcoal grey western suit and a dark maroon fedora. In his hands are gift bags that he sets down once he sees Renshu. Even though Renshu is 25, not 13, it's still a surprise to meet his uncle's gaze at eye level. Longwei laughs out loud with joy and, to both Meilin and Renshu's shock, gives him a huge hug.
You are marvellous,
he says, his eyes scanning Renshu as if trying to take him all in.
A marvellous young man.
Congratulations on your many honours from NTU. Your father and my father would be so proud. I am proud to be your uncle.
Renju stands up straighter.
Longwei turns to Mei Lin. He's even more handsome and glorious than in the photo.
Come, come in. Have you eaten? She says. Though brisk, her tone is affectionate.
I brought these for you.
Longwei picks up the bags and presents them to Mei Lin. A bottle of brandy and a box from Cafe Astoria. Renshu peeks over Mei Lin's shoulder as she looks inside. It is filled with the pillowy white almond confections.
Russian soft candies, Longwei says.
The evening evaporates as they devour Mei Lin's food and exchange stories. Mei Lin and Renshu rarely drink, but Longwei pours brandy for them all, and the conversation flows. Even so, there are some topics they navigate carefully. Mei Lin glosses over the destruction of her family's compound in the Shanghai years, and Longwei doesn't press for details. When their bellies are full, Renshu clears the table. From the kitchen, he listens to his ma and Longwei talking and laughing. It is as if a whole new dimension of her has come to life, a fullness that he hadn't realized had become muted. He brings out the strawberries, Longwei's special candies, and fresh plates. When he sits back down, the conversation sobers. Longwei clears his throat. He still has his smoker's cough.
Renshu, your ma says you hope to go to the US for graduate studies. What a magnificent opportunity. Tell me more.
Renshu nods, suddenly nervous. He takes out his paperwork and begins to explain all the requirements. Longwei keeps his eyes steadily on Renshu, not looking at the documents that accumulate in front of him in a small pile. Mei Lin sits with her hands folded in her lap, motionless, watching Longwei. When Renshu finishes, Longwei pages through the papers. The offer of admission, the statement of approved political screening from the Security Bureau, a certificate of excellence from the Ministry of Education's English Proficiency Exam, the mostly completed visa application, and finally, an incomplete form. Renshu needs proof of a US bank account with funds to cover expenses and tuition, an estimated $2,400. Renshu is restless. When it comes to the money and the visa, they all know that Longwei is the only one who can aid them. What is Uncle thinking? Will he help? The clock in the hallway chimes 10 o'clock.
Uncle, Renshu says, rising from the table. I am sorry. I must go now. I have to get back to the barracks.
Longwei picks up the documents and taps them on the table, straightening them into a tidy stack.
Leave the papers with me, he says. What good fortune that our family is together again.
Thank you for the many ways you have always helped us, Renshu says to Longwei, keeping his voice neutral and sincere, before leaving with a bow. After the door closes, Mei Lin and Longwei sit in silence. The Huangs will return tomorrow from Hsinchu, and Mei Lin still has preparations to make. But she's not ready for the evening to end yet. Just for tonight, she can imagine that this is her house. Mei Lin reaches towards the brandy bottle to refill their glasses. Longwei grasps her arm.
Marry me, Mei Lin.
What? She stares at him and tugs her arm free, setting the brandy back down.
I mean it. Marry me.
She laughs, then realizes that he's not joking.
We've shared so much loss. Who else could understand?
Mei Lin brings her hand to her mouth, holding back a wild torrent of questions.
Is he mad? What could he be thinking? Is this a trick? Say something.
Is that fear in his eyes? Even when he's had some of her best interests at heart, there was all this more at play.
Say something, he repeats.
It's never wise to give a gambler what he wants on the first ask. Help Renshu first. She studies his face. She knows she's pressing on an old wound. She could tell by the way Longwei watched Renshu tonight that he still loves his nephew, still longs for a son.
Marry me, he says again. Everything will be so much easier.
easier? When has ease ever been the measure of his methods, or hers? Through all her years of struggle, getting remarried has never appealed to Mei-Lin. Her independence has been too hard won to relinquish to some man. But this isn't some stranger. This is Long Wei, who, in many ways, knows her better than anyone. Long Wei, please help him. This is his chance. Keeping eye contact, Long Wei stands, then reaches for his blazer and fedora. He takes his time putting them on. Finally, he picks up the documents and rolls the papers into a loose scroll that he holds in one hand. Beautiful dinner tonight. Thank you. Mei-Lin's heart is in her throat. She stands, too, wondering if they have asked too much, if she should have said yes to his proposal. She walks him to the door, uncertain what to say, massaging the knuckles of one hand with the fingers of the other as Long Wei changes back into his street shoes. Standing in the doorframe, backlit by the lantern outside, he leans forward and lifts an errant curl from the side of her face, tucking it back behind her ear. Then he gives Mei-Lin a half bow and heads out into the night. They wait. As days turn to weeks, March passes. Then it is April, and the humidity rises as their hopes drop. By May, Mei-Lin doubts everything. Did she hand Renshu's future to someone who will squander it? Might Long Wei give the papers to someone else along with his money? Should she have accepted Long Wei's marriage proposal? Aside from Long Wei's response, whether good or bad, there are so many other ways in which this opportunity could fall apart. The visa could be denied. There might not be enough boat tickets. The government could change its mind. The money could come too late. A summer typhoon could wash away the offices and all the paperwork. She finds herself imagining one disastrous scenario after another. Renshu has just finished a training drill, sweating in the June heat. He'll be glad when his compulsory service is over. Though he knows it's his duty to be ready to defend the Republic, he hates the thought of battle. He isn't a bad shot, but the drills leave him shaky, even if the targets are only black silhouettes. When they practice hand grenade deployment, he was sick and had to leave the field. Because he had demonstrated excellence in all other areas, his commanding officer grudgingly let him off the hook. Whatever happens with his visa application, he's determined not to stay in the military. As he approaches the barracks, he sees Long Wei leaning on a motor car and smoking a cigarette. Long Wei's stance suggests that it has been years since he stood at strict attention for anyone. Renshu rushes over, his heart beating faster. Good news? Bad news? Why had his uncle come? Long Wei takes a last drag, then throws the cigarette butt down and extinguishes it with his foot. Renshu, let's walk. As Long Wei inquires about his training, his ma, her health, Renshu is very proper. He gives short, clipped answers. His stride is straight and disciplined. Relax, Long Wei finally says. This is a friendly visit, not an examination. He looks at Renshu. You know, you look just like your father. Renshu doesn't know what to say. Long Wei sighs sadly and shakes his head. And are you a patriot, too? Do you wish to become as great a soldier as he was? Uncle, if necessary, I would serve the Republic with honour and diligence, but...
But what?
I wouldn't choose a career in the military. Long Wei purses his lips and furrows his brows slightly. Renshu worries that his candour was foolish. Perhaps he should have been more diplomatic.
I was in the military for many years.
Long Wei reaches into his pocket for his cigarettes and lighter.
But I can understand your position. After my time on the battlefield, I found other, better ways to fight. After all, there is always an enemy and always a war, but one does not always have to be a soldier.
He offers Renshu a cigarette. Renshu shakes his head. Long Wei shrugs and lights his own cigarette, takes a long inhale and exhale.
What about working for the government?
Do you dream of returning from your studies in the US to be a civil servant?
Does this mean Longwei has decided to help?
Renchu is unsure how to answer. While not unpatriotic, he'd be reluctant to work for the KMT. He's heard about far too many beatings, mysterious disappearances, and other difficulties for those who voice unpopular opinions, even within the ranks. Though affiliation with the government seems like a good thing, it will come at a price. His ma has always taught him that it's better to stay uninvolved.
Clever boy, Longwei murmurs, not too quick to answer, to please. You look like your father, but you think like your mother.
Renju stares at Longwei.
Above all else, Mei Lin is pragmatic.
Is that a compliment or a condemnation?
What was my father like?
Renchu decides to avoid the question if he can't be honest.
Xiaowen? Xiaowen was...
For a few paces, Longwei considers, then responds.
He was also clever, with books, with art. He had an eye for quality.
Then, in a bittersweet tone,
he was a good man.
Renchu smiles, glad to hear this. They continue walking. Renchu steals a look at Longwei. As a child, he idolized, even loved his uncle. Longwei, who always seemed so full of confidence and swagger, looks weary now. Silvery tips poke through his short hair. There are extra folds of skin around his neck and jaw. Longwei turns and looks back at Renchu.
Your ma,
he starts, uncertainly. Renchu raises his eyebrows and nods, encouraging Longwei to go on.
Did she ever...
He pauses, backing away from his own question. Did she ever what? Renchu peers at the older man's face, inscrutable.
In the years we were all apart, did she ever mention me?
Of course, uncle. We looked for you everywhere in Shanghai. She looked for you when you first got here too, reading the newspapers, asking around. We wanted to find you, but eventually we had to...
His voice trails off.
Give up? Leave the memories behind? He doesn't want to say either of these things, although both are true. Longwei shakes his head and gestures, as if waving away the topic. Although Renchu has answered his uncle's question, he has a feeling Longwei hasn't asked what he really wanted to know. The conversation shifts to other topics, and soon they have looped around the compound and are back near the barracks. At the car, Longwei squints at Renchu, taking him in one more time.
Arrange your boat ticket to the US,
he instructs, then gets in. Renchu stands in shock, watching Longwei drive away. It's going to happen. He's going to America. All those years of hope and struggle and hard work, all those pieces of the puzzle that he painstakingly assembled. Dumbfounded, he looks around. He hears laughter from the barracks, where the soldiers are glad to be off duty for the evening. Catching their energy, he whoops aloud. He can't wait to tell his ma. Renchu gets a ticket on the next cargo ship, pleased that many of his classmates will be travelling on the same boat. The journey to America will take months. But a week before the departure date, even as Longwei tells him to finish packing, he produces no papers. The final days pass in a flurry. Mei Lin avoids conversations with her neighbours as she doesn't want to jinx their good fortune. There is too much to do. Clothes to sew, suitcases to find and fill. Where is Longwei? The night before the boat is due to leave, when the wait has gone from worrying to excruciating, Longwei finally turns up with a sealed envelope.
This has Renshu's passport, visa, sponsorship letter and bank information. All the necessary documents are here. Keep it all together. Keep it sealed.
He turns to Renchu.
When you get to immigration, hand all the papers to the officials. Make sure you get them all back. I've included contact information for Chen Yuming, the son of an old friend of mine. He also studies at Northwestern and he'll help you. Keep all the papers in a safe place.
He hands Mei Lin the envelope.
It's lighter than she expects. Is this thin sheaf of paper strong enough to carry her boy across the ocean? Mei-Lin gives the envelope to Renshu, who takes it and embraces Longwei. Caught off guard by this burst of affection, Longwei stumbles slightly, then embraces Renshu back, murmuring in his ear, "Study hard, and don't get involved in politics." Renshu nods. Longwei then takes Mei-Lin's hand in his. "For family," Longwei says. "For family," she agrees. Keelung Harbour, Taiwan, July 1960. He is waving from the boat, surrounded by his classmates. They are the best students from the top universities. They are the luckiest of the lucky, the most talented of the top. Her boy stands among them. Mei-Lin thinks of departing Changsha 22 years ago, driven away by fear and fires. She was younger then than he is now. There was no knowing what lay ahead. Today, he looks towards his future with hope. The wind snaps the flags in the boat to attention. They have been one another's only constant. When everything else was uncertain, they found certainty in each other. She always believed that Renshu would be okay. He was a good boy, and he has become a good man. She hopes that he will be happy, that he finds a good life, that he feels safe and loved. She raises her hand, waves it once. He waves back, triumphant, elated. A friend next to him throws an arm around his shoulder. Renshu gestures towards Mei-Lin, and his friend sees her. He too gives her a huge grin. She waves again. The boys wave one last time, then disappear into the crowd of passengers. The crew is taking up the gangplanks. Horns are sounding. All around, people cheer and wave, but Mei-Lin stands still. He's going to America, the beautiful country. It is what he wanted, what he dreamed of. When she sees Renshu again, if she sees him again, he will be filled with a home she doesn't know. He will speak a language she doesn't understand. He will have eaten foods she has never tasted and seen sights beyond her imagining. He will be so far away, further than he has ever been. She feels like she is breaking apart, whether from joy or sorrow she can't say. A kindly woman next to her says, "We are so proud of our boys, aren't we?" Mei-Lin nods, and tears roll off her nose. She has never felt more bereft. Part 4, 1960 to 1968. Chapter 15, New York City, New York, August 1960.
"We need to go. Davinshu's going to cry."
Li Ho-Tan holds out his hand for a handshake. A long, silvery greyhound has just pulled into its bay at the Port Authority bus terminal, and passengers are boarding. Renshu's suitcase and satchel sit at his feet. It's time to say goodbye to his friends, Li, Pao, and Guo. The voyage took nearly 2 months, making stops in the Philippines and Hawaii, and passing through the Panama Canal before finally docking in New York. About 30 students sailed on the ship, each with a dream of America. Renshu spent countless hours with Li Ho-Tan, Pao Dafei, and Guo Yao, playing card games, telling stories, and comparing hopes. Now it's time to go their separate ways. Li and Pao will stay here in New York City for their studies at Columbia and NYU. Guo will soon board a bus to Boston. Renshu is the only one from this group headed to the Midwest. Renshu grasps Li's hand, blinks hard, and swallows. He is filled with gratitude for Li and Pao.
"I'm not going to cry," he protests.
Li clasps his other hand around Renshu's.
"Of course not. Me neither," he says, blinking hard. "Zaijian."
"Zaijian," Renshu says. Then, "See you again," tasting the words in English. The bus rumbles west through the crimsons and oranges of a summer sunset and into the night. Through the length of Pennsylvania, Renshu dozes fitfully. When the bus struggles up a hill, the revving engine and shifting gears jar him awake. Going down, the turns in the road and the squeaking brakes jostle him. No matter which way he shifts in the seat, he feels stiff and squashed. Eventually, he falls asleep in an uncomfortable slouch. Renshu wakes to a sore neck and a gnawing stomach. Blearily, he watches the land pass by his window. Last night's hills and valleys have flattened out into farmland that stretches for miles. Some fields, already harvested, have been shorn bare. Others still wave with row after row of sweet corn, the green stalks tipped by gall. There are no labourers working the land, no lines of bamboo hats, scythes and baskets. Instead, huge tractors and mysterious equipment crawl across the fields, digging several furrows at once. Where are all the people? Passengers are starting to wake around him, coughing, stretching. He doesn't know anyone here. When they stop for breakfast and a fuel break, everyone scatters in different directions. Renshu, afraid of becoming lost, must not let the bus driver out of his sight. He buys what the driver buys for breakfast. He sits where he can see his green uniform. When the driver uses the toilet, Renshu does too, rushing so that he doesn't get left behind. He cannot be left here, wherever here is. Back on the bus, the hours pass. In the seats behind him, a woman gripes, "Joshua, stop teasing your brother." "No, Evan, no more snacks." Across the aisle, two women look through a photo album. "That's Charlie. He's the one that Nancy was after at the picnic. Oh yes, and then that's Cousin Darren." So many new names. Renshu has a new name too, for his American life. It had happened one evening, not long after they sailed from Taiwan. Western names kept bubbling to the surface of the dinner conversation, followed by cackles of laughter and applause. Peter, Stephen, Benjamin, Alexander, Jerry. "And what about you? What will your name be, Dao Renshu?" He didn't understand what they were asking. "You need to choose a different name, a Western name," Li Hutan explained. "I shall be..." And he paused until all eyes were on him. "Andrew Lee." He extended his arm in a flourish, enjoying the ceremony. "Why would I choose a different name?" "It's easier that way. When you fill out papers, when you open a bank account, when you meet a girl, an American girl maybe, if you have Western name, it's easier for them to pronounce and remember it." Wenshu blinked. He said nothing. "In America, when you meet someone, you don't say your family name first, but just this name," said Guo. "A name is a calling card. A name is a handshake. A name is an entry onto the stage," someone else added. "It's how you start an introduction. Pleased to meet you. I'm Andrew." Li Hotan held his hand out to Renshu. More names, more guffaws. They scraped their chopsticks against empty bowls and continued their banter long after the meal had ended. A few weeks into the journey, Renshu had lain awake one night, restless. He'd risen and turned on the small lamp above the desk in the cabin he'd shared with three others. They stirred, but no one woke. His eye fell on the book Lee had been reading, Walden, by Henry David Thoreau. Renshu flipped through until he found a sentence where he had no need for his English dictionary. "Heaven is under our feet as well as over our heads." The sea beneath was unsteady. The sky above was endless. This seemed to be as true a statement as any. Henry. From his satchel, he took out a piece of paper, an inkstone, an inkstick, a brush and his fountain pen. He emptied the remaining drops of tea from a mug into the tray of the inkstone and rubbed the stone back and forth, watching the ink darken and pool. With his brush, in careful strokes, he wrote "Dao Renshu" down the right side of the paper. He put the brush down and waited for the ink to dry. Then he uncapped his pen and wrote "Henry Dao" in a horizontal line on the left side. He folded the paper and put it in his pocket. Still wide awake, he went up to the deck and stood, resting his arms on the railings. A nighttime captain nodded to him, but didn't ask any questions. No matter how far Renchu looked, there was no land in sight. He was somewhere between China and Taiwan and America. The stars shone like they had never been dimmed by smoking buildings or the heavy haze of humidity. The sea was still. No moon, no wind. Only a quiet ticking of the ship's engines. He was no longer Dao Renchu. He was not yet Henry Dao. Hovering somewhere above these two names, he stood on the deck and watched the horizon until the eastern sky began to colour.
Evanston? Ah, you're going to need the L.
Renshu draws back. Did the bus driver just tell him to go to hell? But I am going to Evanston, Northwestern University. Renshu holds out his ticket. The driver peers at Renshu's ticket while loudly working a piece of chewing gum from one side of his mouth to the other.
Buddy, they sold you the wrong ticket. Look.
He points with his stubby forefinger, dirt caked under the nails.
Port Authority Bus Terminal, New York, to Chicago Bus Terminal, Illinois.
He jabs his finger at the word Chicago for emphasis, leaving a greasy smudge.
This is the end of the road for me. Like I said, take the L.
And he turns and walks through a door labelled Do Not Enter.
You go to hell, Renshu scowls at the closed door.
Now what? He's lost somewhere between his friends in New York and his destination in Evanston, and doesn't know a single person in between. After rehearsing his question and working up his courage, he asks at the ticket counter. Elated that the woman understands him, her answer speeds by and he doesn't catch the details. He's too embarrassed to ask her to repeat herself.
Okay,
he says, and walks back to the waiting area. It's hot. He takes off his heavy coat, which is far too warm for the late summer heat, but too bulky to fit in his suitcase. He stares at his suitcase and satchel.
Should he walk?
He doesn't know which direction to go. He doesn't know the distance. Is he near? Far? He studies the boards with timetables. There are listings for New York, Philadelphia, Indianapolis, Milwaukee. Nothing about Evanston.
Can I help you? Are you lost?
Asks a young man with glasses and dusty brown hair. He wears a tan V-neck sweater over a red check shirt and dark brown trousers. Like Renshu, the man has a single suitcase and a satchel. There is a reassuring openness in his manner.
Yes, yes, Renshu says.
Flustered, he looks down at his ticket, then back up at the man.
Where do you want to go?
Evanston, Northwestern University, Renshu manages to say.
I thought that might be the case, says the man, nodding. Me too. Come on, we'll take the L.
He motions for Renshu to follow him out of the door. Renshu looks up and down the road. No rickshaws or carts. No cheerful ringing of bicycle bells. Cars fill the streets. Horns blare. People shout. Everywhere are street signs and shop signs and newspaper stands, but Renshu can't stop to work out what they say. He must keep up with the man. There is a rumbling overhead. Astonished, Renshu looks up through dark green metal arches to see a train.
A train? In the air? Hey, this way. Got some change?
The man is dropping coins into a turnstile. Renshu is relieved to see the cost is in coins and not bills. Renshu reaches into his pocket, counts out the fare, and pushes the bar to go through. They rush up a staircase to an elevated platform just as a train arrives. It's crowded. They squeeze in and stand, holding overhead straps to keep from stumbling as the train lurches away over the streets. The man holds out his free hand.
I'm Richard. Richard Addison. And this is the L, short for elevated train.
Henry, whispers Renshu.
Pardon?
Richard leans forward. He can't hear over the squealing and shifting of the train. They turn a corner and Renshu almost falls. He steadies himself, takes a breath, and says it more loudly, returning the handshake. Henry, I'm Henry Dow. Evanston, Illinois, September 1960. Longways contact, Chen Yuming, or, as he calls himself in America, Charles Chen, is a little older than Henry and has an easy manner and friendly smile. He's been at Northwestern for about a year studying economics. He looks vaguely familiar. Perhaps he was finishing at NTU when Henry was first starting? Chen agrees this is possible, but he's been in the US for a few years now. Before starting graduate school, Chen was in Chicago, helping with his uncle's business. He still goes down to visit quite often. A room in the boarding house where Chen stays is available, and Henry gladly moves in after Chen puts in a good word for him with Mrs. Patterson, the landlady. Henry and Chen are the only Chinese in the house. The majority of the other boarders are Americans. They are welcoming, but mostly keep a polite distance, even from each other. Everyone is focused on their work or studies. At the boarding house, Henry has a whole room of his own, not shared with anyone. His books are on his desk, his clothes are folded and put away in the dresser. There are still a few empty drawers. In the closet hang his coat, a few dress shirts, and a blazer for special occasions. At the bottom sits an extra pair of shoes. When he first arrives, he turns the lights on and off several times, just for the luxury. The street outside is lined by large trees, oaks, elms, maples. The shapes of the leaves fascinate him. There are no twisty, sprawling banyan groves reclaiming anything in their path, or delicate, fan-shaped ginkgo leaves brushing the air. Every so often, a car drives by. A mother pushes a buggy up the sidewalk. So quiet. So different from the bright heat of Taipei, the palms and azaleas of the boulevard at NTU, or the merry night markets. It is strange, this sense of heat without a sea nearby, air without the scent of salt or fish. Chen shows Henry around the neighbourhood, tells him where to get second-hand copies of textbooks, advises him on the paperwork for international students. It is Chen who helps him get a job in the cafeteria as a busboy, so he can eat for free as well as earn some money. With the job and the money from Uncle Longway, Henry has enough for rent, books, supplies, and blue aerogram letters to write to his ma once a month. As long as he is thrifty and works hard, money will be no problem. Henry's studies command most of his attention and energy. Months pass in a routine of going to lectures, studying, and working at the cafeteria. In his letters to Mei Lin, Henry tries to describe American football, donuts, pizza, and the way the trees reach and arch over his road, describing the autumn as a tunnel of gold. When the weather turns cold, Henry wears his thick coat and new boots, walking through the spicy crunch of fallen leaves. It isn't until the winter that his first waves of homesickness arise. Somehow, the excitement of all that was new has carried him through the first semester, but in the early months of the year, with bitter winds howling off Lake Michigan and short days offering only the weakest of sunlight, his longing for his ma and the comforts of Taiwan intensifies. On the evening of the Lunar New Year, Henry sits at his desk with a half-finished letter for Mei Lin. For months, he has been trying to find his way around his new language with a frozen tongue. He reaches for his Chinese-English dictionary. It is as thick and heavy as a brick. The thin pages sound like moth's wings as he flips back and forth, looking for words to understand this kind of cold. When he writes to his ma, the Chinese characters flow like a river down the page, thawing his words. Ma, the winter snows are fierce and sharp. I don't remember ever seeing snow in Taiwan. The winds are like screeching demons that shake the trees. The bare branches scrape my windows in a fury. Some days I wear two pairs of socks and both of my sweaters, and I still feel cold. Today is the Lunar New Year. I wonder what you are doing. Are you making radish cakes for the Huangs? Sharing a fish and gossiping with Auntie Chin?
Do you remember when we lit lanterns and made wishes in the streets of Shanghai? Ma, I miss you.
Henry puts down his pen and stands up, stretching his arms, then wanders over to the window. He pulls back the curtain and feels a cold draft steal into the room. Outside, the street lamps are blurry and yellow. It is calm, except for the occasional bright movement of headlights coming down the road or red taillights receding. In Taipei tonight, firecrackers are flying and dragon dancers are weaving through the streets to drumbeats so loud and deep that you can feel them in your belly. A flurry of red envelopes is exchanging hands. Spilling from open shop fronts are pyramids of oranges and pomegranates, boxes of kumquats, nuts and candies carefully arranged and tied up with red strings.